Aragon Santiago, Mr. Crooks.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. Tim Crooks for Jose Mondragon Santiago. The first issue presented by this appeal is the reasonableness of the sentence, both procedural and substantive. And this afternoon, I would like to focus my argument on one particular aspect of the procedural reasonableness inquiry, which is whether the district court adequately explained its reasons for sentence, especially in light of the fact that it did not explain why it was rejecting Mr. Mondragon Santiago's non-frivolous arguments for a lower sentence. It is our contention that under the relevant precedents, the district court did not adequately explain its sentence, and therefore the court should vacate and remand for resentencing. Just very briefly, the facts as relate to this particular issue are as follows. The pre-sentence report calculated guidelines of 46 to 57 months. Mr. Mondragon Santiago did not challenge that guideline calculation, but he did ask for a below-guideline sentence for a variety of reasons. Primarily, he argued that the guideline range was excessive because his sole felony conviction, a Texas aggravated assault for which he had received deferred adjudication and 4 years probation, had a disproportionate effect on his guidelines in two ways. One, because it enhanced the offense level from 8 to 24, 16-level bump in the guideline offense level, and it was responsible for 4 out of his 6 criminal history points. Defense counsel also pointed out that Mr. Mondragon Santiago had never served more than 90 days in prison before. That was the most he had ever served, and suddenly he was looking at a guideline range that was 15 to 19 times greater than the most he had ever served before. Defense counsel also pointed out it was Mr. Mondragon's first 1326 offense, and he did not have a history of illegally reentering into the country. The whole thrust of the argument was that something less than the guideline range of 46 to 57 months would have been sufficient but not greater than necessary to achieve the purposes of sentencing that are set out in 18 U.S.C. section 3553A2. The district court at sentencing asked a few questions to clarify a few discrete factual matters, but it did not address the arguments that I just mentioned. When the district court pronounced sentence, it simply recited the offense level, the criminal history category, and the guideline range of 46 to 57 months, and then it sentenced Mr. Mondragon Santiago to 50 months imprisonment. The court did not explain its reasons for imposition of sentence, and particularly it did not explain why it was rejecting Mr. Mondragon Santiago's arguments for a below-guideline sentence. In fact, throughout this sentencing hearing, the district court did not mention 18 U.S.C. section 3553A at all. After the sentence was imposed, defense counsel objected to the sentence as being greater than necessary, and the district court overruled that objection. Now, of course, the governing case law, the governing rule is set out in the Supreme Court's decision in Rita, where the Supreme Court told us that the sentencing judge should set forth enough to satisfy the appellate court that he has considered the party's arguments and has a reasoned basis for exercising his own legal decision-making authority.
Mr. Crooks, one question here. The counsel did not object on the basis that he hadn't given reasons, though.
He did not specifically state that the district court had not given sufficient reasons, but we would argue that by arguing that the sentence was greater than necessary, it was necessarily an objection that the district court had not given a justification for that particular sentence, a sentence of that length.
Do you have any authority for that proposition?
I do not, Your Honor. But I would note that I don't believe that any of this Court's cases that have applied the plain error standard review, if I recall correctly, none of them actually present a situation where someone actually objected to the sentence after it was imposed. And so that might be a distinguishing factor. In the alternative, I would submit that even if the plain error standard is applied, this was plain error under the familiar four-prong Olano test. First, by not explaining why it rejected Mr. Mondragon Santiago's non-frivolous arguments for a lower sentence, the district court plainly ran afoul of Rita and a host of other cases, including this court's case in United States v. Tisdale, that require the district court to explain why it's rejecting non-frivolous arguments for a lower sentence. And we submit that that error is plain within the meaning of the plain error rule under Rita and Tisdale and a host of other cases from other circuits we cited in the briefs. Furthermore, it affected Mr. Mondragon Santiago's substantial rights because, as is explained in the N. Ray Sealed case that we submitted in our second 28J letter, Judge Brown, writing for the D.C. Circuit, explained that this type of error affects a defendant's substantial rights because it precludes effective appellate review of the substantive reasonableness of the sentence. As she also wrote for the D.C. Circuit, it also affects the it seriously affects the fairness, integrity, and public reputation of judicial proceedings because, as the Supreme Court also explained in Rita, the statement of reasons or explanation of the sentence is critical for the defendant and the public to have trust in the judicial institution and to make sure that the sentencing process is a reasoned one. So we would submit that under Rita and Tisdale and the other authorities, even under a plain error standard of review, the court should find plain error and should correct that error by vacating the sentence and remanding for resentencing.
If anything, did the court in this case say less than the court did in the N. Ray Sealed case? Judge Kavanaugh has an extensive dissent saying, well, the court in that case actually said enough. But in this record's more sparse, isn't it?
I would say it's much more sparse, and I would also point out that this case is much more sparse than what the district court did in the Rita case. You can actually look at the transcript of the sentencing in Rita. It's in the joint appendix that was filed with the brief in the Supreme Court. And that was a case where the judge went on for literally dozens of pages discussing factors with defense counsel and saying much, much more than was actually said in this case. And I would submit that this is one of the sparsest explanations that I've seen, especially in light of the fairly detailed presentation that was made and the objection that was specifically made after the sentence was imposed. There is a second reason why the court should vacate the sentence and remand for resentencing, which is presented in our second issue. That issue asks whether Mr. Mondragon Santiago had a qualifying aggravated felony so as to trigger application of 8 U.S.C. section 1326b2. The answer to that question we submit is no, and here's why. Mr. Mondragon Santiago's only felony conviction, as I mentioned before, was this 2003 aggravated assault conviction out of Dallas County. He had adjudication deferred on that conviction, and he was placed directly on 4 years probation. There was no suspension of any prison sentence. He was placed directly on probation, which is the usual course for Texas deferred adjudications. In order for that ag assault to count as an aggravated felony, he would have had to have received, under 8 U.S.C. section 1101A43F, 1 year of imprisonment or more for it. And it could have been a suspended prison sentence, but there had to be at least 1 year of prison imposed, albeit if later suspended. This court has squarely held that, as is the case with Texas deferred adjudications, when a defendant is placed directly on probation, the sentence does not meet this one-year threshold to qualify it as a crime of violence and an aggravated felony under section 1101A43F. For this reason, it was plain error to sentence Mr. Mondragon Santiago as an aggravated felon, and we would ask that the court correct this error by not only reforming the judgment but vacating and remanding for resentencing. And in this regard, we think that it's especially critical here that for purposes of showing a reasonable probability of a different outcome on remand, as of November 1, 2008, the Sentencing Commission has explicitly amended USSG Section 2L1.2 to provide for a downward departure in this very factual scenario, which is where someone gets a 16-level enhancement for something that doesn't qualify as an aggravated felony. And that is in Application Note 7B to the amended 2L1.2, and we attached the amended version of the guideline to our first 28J letter. Now, in its response to our 28J letter, the government suggested that Mr. Mondragon Santiago would not, on a remand, be able to avail himself of that ground for departure because of 18 U.S.C. Section 3742 G1. The government is just flat wrong about that, because if you look at 3742 G1, what it says is that when you are computing the guideline range on remand, you apply the guidelines in effect on the date of the original sentencing, not on the date of resentencing. But it's speaking only to calculating the guideline range. It doesn't speak at all to departures or variances. It's simply inapplicable to this particular situation. We're not claiming a change in the guideline range. We're claiming something that has to do with a departure ground.
Do you have authority for that proposition?
For G1?
For the idea that it doesn't apply to departures.
Well, we would submit that the language of the statute is sufficiently clear to show that it applies only in computing the guideline range and not for any other purpose. Now, to follow up on your question, however, 3742 G2, which was not cited by the government, does say that generally on a remand, the district court may not sentence outside the guidelines except for a very few limited exceptions. However, we submit that 3742 G2 is plainly unconstitutional after Booker because it essentially reinstitutes the same sort of mandatory guideline sentencing that the Supreme Court struck down in Booker. And we would be happy to provide the court with authority to that effect regarding the viability of 3742 G2 if the court would like it. We'll be glad to give it in a 28J letter later. The upshot is that under Booker, the district court, we submit, would be free to deviate from the guidelines on remand on a ground that is approved and encouraged by the Sentencing Commission in new application note 7B. And this approved ground for sentencing below the guidelines shows, we think, beyond a reasonable doubt, that there is at least a reasonable probability that Mr. Mondragon Santiago would receive a lower sentence on remand, and therefore his substantial rights were affected by the miscategorization of the prior conviction as an aggravated felony. Therefore, we ask that even if the court doesn't reverse and remand based on the error we described in Issue 1, that the court nevertheless give us the same relief based on the error we describe in Issue 2.
Now, if we didn't, if we weren't inclined to agree with you on Issue 2, you would still want us to reform the sentence because of reentry issues, is that correct?
The judgment, at a minimum, the judgment should be reformed to strike the reference to 1326b2. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Berry?
May it please the court, Mr. Crooks. Good morning. Richard Berry from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Houston, Texas. At the outset, I don't believe that Mr. Crooks and I are in substantial disagreement as to the law on the first issue. We are in complete disagreement or near complete disagreement as to the application of that law to the facts of Mr. Mondragon Santiago's case. As to the second issue, well, as the first issue, Judge Elrod, you ask about sealed case. Sealed case and essentially all the other cases that Mr. Crook cites in his rather well-written brief are distinguishable on the facts. Sealed case involved a two-day hearing on revocation of supervised release. At the end of that, defense counsel, the defendant himself, and the United States had all presented substantial reasons for various and sundry sentences. The United States asked for 12 months. The probation officer asked for 5 years. Defense counsel asked for the minimum sentence the district court would impose. This case, Mondragon Santiago, is the quintessence of Rita, Gall, and Kimbrough. It is a mine-run case. It is a run-of-the-mill case. It is a typical illegal reentry after deportation case from the Valley, and they're done 20, 30, 40, 50 a day. There was absolutely nothing out of the ordinary in this case, and under Rita, and particularly Gall and Kimbrough, the district court was not required to do anything more than what it did. Mr. Mondragon Santiago's written objection to the PSR contained the pro forma Almendarez-Torres objection, which this court rejected in Pineda-Arellano, and request for a variance or a departure under 4A1.2 of the guidelines, claiming that the sentence was overly harsh. However, there's no objection to the 16-level enhancement for having committed a prior aggravated felony, in this case, a crime of violence, aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. And there was no contention that either the total offense level or the criminal history category were miscalculated. As such, there's no substantive disagreement with the guideline, with the advisory guideline calculation range. There's simply a request in this case, lodged largely orally at the sentencing hearing, for some sentence below the guidelines, which of course the district court understood that it had the authority to do under Booker, Rita, Gall, and Kimbrough. The crux of the sentencing hearing, which is only 10 pages in toto, was that Mr. Mondragon Santiago wanted to be with his wife and his family in Dallas, which is perfectly understandable, and that 46 to 57 months was an excess sentence. Review of the PSR shows that his wife is illegally in this country, although she is gainfully employed. In response to questions directly from the district court, Mr. Mondragon Santiago said that he needed to be with his family to support his children. The court asked about his children. The district court asked about his wife and was informed that the wife was fully and gainfully employed. And then the district court asked the obvious question. If you are an illegal alien and your two children, who are U.S. citizens by virtue of having been born here, are in Dallas, how do you plan to be with them? Mr. Mondragon Santiago began to answer, well, I need to be with them to take care of them, to teach them. And then he realized that he was in the process of confessing to a district judge who was about to sentence him that he intended to reenter the country illegally again as soon as he had the opportunity. And so he recanted that line and said, well, if the government won't let me come back, then I can't be with them. The district court then imposed a sentence. I believe the district court also noted that perhaps the children can come and see you when you're incarcerated. I would respectfully submit the district court was not required to do anything else because this is a mine-run case, a typical illegal reentry case that required no further analysis on the part of the district court. The district court correctly calculated the guidelines range, and Mr. Crooks does not contend otherwise. The district court imposed a sentence from the middle of the correctly calculated guideline range. That sentence is entitled to a presumption of reasonableness on appeal, and there is nothing in the record that presumption.
What do you say about the reasons that he's giving, though, for why it isn't a mine run case, namely about the way this whole thing was computed, his underlying felony got counted really three different times?
Your Honor, essentially that is true, but there's nothing in the guidelines that prevents over-calculating, but there's nothing that prevents double counting unless a specific guideline says so. That was taken into consideration by the Sentencing Commission when they promulgated the guidelines themselves. The total offense level is calculated separate from criminal history category, the fact that he got a 16-level enhancement.
Well, I don't think he's arguing that that means that the sentence, that the guideline was sentence was incorrectly computed. He's saying that that's a reason for the district judge to go to depart downward that the district judge did not address.
Well, I would respectfully submit that it is a reason, but it is such a mundane reason, particularly in illegal reentry cases. The district court, implicitly addressed it by simply rejecting it. It was something that the district court and both of the attorneys present would have understood was calculated into the guidelines when the guidelines were promulgated. That would be true in any illegal reentry case. And all of the cases that Mr. Crook cites are distinguishable by their factual complexity or their legal complexity. The cases from his opening brief, Cirillo, Munoz, and Thomas, and Sevilla from the letter brief, all involve something far beyond Peters and Baker and Miranda, all involve something substantially beyond a legal reentry. It is a very simple offense that has three elements that unfortunately, as the court is all too well aware, occupies a vastly disproportionate percentage of the district court's time, particularly in the border divisions of the Southern District. As to the second issue,
before you get to the second issue,
yes, Your Honor.
Could you please address the Tisdale case?
Oh, certainly, Your Honor. Albeit unpublished, Tisdale is an excellent opinion by Judge Smith, which I would certainly view as binding precedent. The prime difference would be a factual difference, the factual complexity of the case. The Tisdale brothers obtained the identity of recently deceased persons with substantial credit histories, with good credit histories, and then either got loans in their names or drew on lines of credit using the two Tisdale brothers' businesses to obtain credit history reports on the deceased persons. Judging from the perfunctory Westlaw portion of the case, I also gather that one of the Tisdale brothers is an attorney and represented himself pro se. Michael Tisdale's range was 78 to 97. Williams was 97 to 121. They were both sentenced to 97 months. Judge Smith states that all the parties presented 3553A arguments. The Tisdale brothers argued that the sentence was greater than necessary to protect the public from further crimes by the defendants and to defer criminal conduct by others, and that the guideline range created a substantial disparity between the Tisdale brothers and their co-defendants in this case. Apparently, the United States had also offered 3553A arguments in favor of a sentence outside the guideline range. The district court gave no indication it had considered these arguments or any of the 3553A factors. It merely restated the guideline range and imposed sentence.
Which is what happened here, right?
Well, Your Honor, I wouldn't agree without further explanation. It is what happened here after Judge Stagg discussed the only real factor that Mondragon Santiago raised, that he needed to be with his children and that he needed to support his children. Obviously, he didn't. I would also note that Judge Stagg imposed a sentence from the middle of the guideline range, which should eviscerate any suggestion that he was contemplating a deviation either above or below the guideline range. He obviously thought that this was a mine run case by picking a sentence from the middle of the advisory guideline range. I would submit that there's nothing on the record to indicate that he was confused in any way about his ability to depart from the range had he so desired. There was simply nothing here that would warrant a departure or a variance.
So are you saying in mine run cases that consideration of the 3553A factors is discretionary and not essential in determining the reasonable sentence, as opposed to Tisdale, where it says that you must consider the factors and that it's essential?
No.
Specifically, consider them.
No, not at all, Your Honor. I would say that consideration of the 3553A factors is the benchmark of sentencing, particularly after Rita Gall and Kimbrough.
Right. So, but you don't have to do as much in a...
I would say that in a mine run case, if there's no non-trivial ground for variance from the guideline range, there's no reason to go on and on at length as to why a particular sentence was selected. Again, in this case, the only thing presented to Judge Stagg were the family considerations, which I would submit that he had addressed. The Tisdales Tisdale presented a substantially more complex fact pattern. There were arguments about all the sentencing factors. There were arguments about the loss calculation, the restitution order. There were arguments about the role in the offense, and so on and so forth. This was simply illegal reentry after deportation with a correctly calculated guideline range.
Okay.
As to the second issue, I would agree with Mr. Crooks in part. There is no aggravated felony. The word I cannot get around, 1326B requires illegal reentry after deportation following an aggravated felony. Aggravated felony is defined in 8 U.S.C. 1101A43F. It requires a crime of violence for which the sentence imposed is at least a year. The word I cannot get around is imposed, because under Texas deferred adjudication, probation, now referred to as adult community supervision, there is no sentence imposed. On rereading Bandera-Zamora and Gracias-Garcia, both of which are cited in the brief, there is no sentence imposed under deferred adjudication or adult community supervision, so there is no aggravated felony, so there is no 8 U.S.C. 1326b2 conviction. I would respectfully submit that it has absolutely no bearing on the guideline calculation or the ultimate advisory guideline range, and all the court need do is reform the judgment to show a conviction under 8 U.S.C. 1326b1 instead of b2, giving Mr. Crooks the benefit of the reduced immigration effect for the 10-year felony as opposed to the 20-year felony. Other than that, there is no reason to remand. The court can simply reform the judgment on its own.
Can we be confident in that, knowing that one was a 20-year and the other's a 10-year, that the court wasn't somehow influenced in the statutory years when the court sentenced?
To a mathematical certainty, obviously not, Your Honor. I would respectfully submit that it was essentially along the lines of the first issue. It was a mine-run case. The fact that it should have been a B1 conviction instead of a B2 conviction has no bearing on the guideline calculation, and there's nothing in Judge Stagg's comments to indicate that he thought that it qualified for anything other than a middle-of-the-guideline range sentence, hence the 50-month sentence from the 46 to 53 guideline range.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to briefly respond to the government's suggestion, which was made repeatedly, that this is a mine run case. This is an illegal reentry case, and the court's very well aware there are hundreds of them coming from the Southern District of Texas every year. But I resist the government's suggestion that this is a mine run case and that there were, as I believe counsel referred to it, no non-trivial arguments for a lower sentence. I think it was very significant in this case, and it was very different from a lot of illegal reentries I've seen, and I've seen plenty of them, that he had only one felony conviction. That one felony conviction he received no jail time for. It was not an aggravated felony conviction, as the government has now conceded. He had only ever served 90 days in jail before. That was the most he had ever served, and I think defense counsel quite rightly argued that a 46 to 57 month sentence was like taking a hammer to a fly, because with a 90-day prior history of imprisonment, there was no reason to believe that as much as 46 to 57 was necessary to get the message across. The thrust of the argument, the principal thrust, yes, Mr. Mondragon Santiago's family were mentioned, but the principal thrust was the 46 to 57-month range is just too much time given his unique history and particularly given his prior conviction history. And I think what is very significant is that the argument that it's too much time is to a very large extent supported and borne out by Application Note 7B in the new guideline, which says that a downward departure may be appropriate in this very scenario where the 16-level bump is caused by something that's not an aggravated felony. You've got the Sentencing Commission now explicitly recognizing that this guideline range may be too much time, and that very neatly dovetails into the argument Mr. Mondragon Santiago made at sentencing long before that amendment was even proposed. So we would urge this is not a mine run case, whatever that means, and that the court should very strictly enforce the rule laid out in Rita and Tisdale that when a defendant gives non-frivolous reasons for a different sentence, the judge should explain why he has rejected those reasons for a lower sentence. And we would ask the court to vacate and remand. Thank you.
Thank you. We call the next case for the afternoon, Cotro.